Accession number 10596, rule 3.
Captain Mahadi, Reel 3.
Well, I'll reiterate, if I may, in order to get the Stirlings, as he did in very shortly, up to 18,000 feet, he took out all the armour plating, save that to protect the pilot underneath his seat. Also, the number of rounds for the guns he reduced by half. He reduced, again by half, the amount of reserve fuel that we all brought back. And so, very easily got the Stirling up to 18,000 feet, where we were much nearer the 20,000, the 22,000 feet that the Lancs operated at, and the 20,000 feet that the Halifaxes used. So, but on that occasion at Flensburg, all I remember was at 12,000 feet being in cloud and going down and down until I got down to I think something like 2,000 feet, and still no sight of the ground. And so that was a complete and utterly wasted sortie. When the Pathfinders really got going, there weren't many wasted sorties, I can assure you.
Well, can you tell me about the improvements that came about in the Pathfinder force, as you actually personally remember them as time went on?
I can remember this very well, because this is something that I'm asked about in all corners of the world when I'm on my lecture tours overseas. First of all, the reason that Bennett was selected as a complete unknown, and after all, he was a captain in Imperial Airways, coming into the Air Force as an acting wing commander, now on the formation of the Pathfinder, an acting group captain. But he was the only officer in our Air Force, or any Air Force, who had a master's license in navigation, Big N, as it was called, the senior navigator's license. He had the post office engineer's license for WT. He could have been the chief wireless operator on the Queen Mary. He had every civil license for engineering. He was also a CFS instructor, and he also had over 10,000 flying hours, which nobody had anything like that in the Air Force. After all, I'd been flying and doing a lot of flying, and I only had 3,500 hours, but I was probably one of the people in the Air Force at the time, regular Air Force, with probably, there wouldn't be more than 100 of us with more than 3,000 hours. Bennett had 10,000 hours. And so, first of all, he realized, like Sid Bufton and the gang in bomber operations in the Air Ministry, that the whole business of our failure to find targets in Germany was one of navigation. It was nothing else. Pilotage was one thing, but only pilots could fly the courses given to them by first-class navigators. So Bennett concentrated on navigation. When we started, we were no better than anybody else, save that this theme that Bennett preached to us, navigation was a thing. Now, the only thing that could help us at the time was a thing called G. Now, G was a device which was radiated from three stations in the UK, radiated a beam of signals, and you could plot these signals because they all merged in a form of a cocked hat, and you could say we're there, and this grid was on a flimsy, was on a transparent flimsy, and you could put that and line it up with the Latin long of the Mercator's projection, and you could say I'm there. Now this is the first time that we could get anywhere within 3 miles, and if you had good G fixes you could get less. But very soon after we got G, and that's by the time we were pathfinders, it was jammed very soon after the 1000 plan, which was in May, and here we are in August, and so we could only use this halfway across the North Sea or to the German coast, no further than the German coast. But it was very nice to know that part on the German coast or the enemy coast, you knew for certain you were within, say, 3 miles. The accuracy was within a mile, but with weaving all the time, and you had to stabilize yourself to get a good fix. That was the only thing we had, and astro. Now Bennett came along, issued us all with astro navigation for sighting stars, and this is something we didn't believe in. But Bennett told us you should get within one nautical mile if you take a good. You took a series of eight sights. You lined up a star and you went click, click, and you took eight shots, and they were computed into one, and you could get within 1 mile. This is something to check up on your G position. And so by checking up on your G position and a star shot, here we were getting at the very roots, the fundamentals of navigation by starlight, which had been going on for hundreds of years, and instilled in us all that this was the be-all and end-all of it. This is before H2S, and this is before OBO. H2S is coming along. I used the first H2S, I think it was in February. I had one of the first H2S's, which I used in February 43. But that was jammed. You couldn't use that. That was to get you to the target, but you couldn't. It was jammed. The moment you switched on H2S, it radiated a signal. The first thing the Germans did, they made a little black box, put it in their fighters, and they homed onto you. They didn't have to ask for a controller on the ground to say, turn onto 014 and do this, that, and the other. They had a device in their cockpit, and it was a needle, and they just kept it vertical under a big O, and they homed right onto you. And then they saw the great flurry of lights from your exhausts, and they gave you a squirt. I'll show you before you go a picture of a Stirling. They got 174 cannon shells up my kilt for my pains. But we got back. However, that was the whole be-all and end-all of the start of pathfinding. Along comes H2S. And so, you knew you couldn't go much further than the enemy coast on H2S. But here you got an absolute pinpoint of where you were on the coast. Now, despite the fact you're weaving all the time, and you settle up, and the thing settles down, and you get a pinpoint on the coast, and then you may come to a big Domazé, or one of these monster lakes that all over Germany, you know, and you just settle up once again. This can be 10 seconds, you see, and you can get a good fix on that. And by this time, we were dropping a marker flare over the Domazé, or over the coast. Not that aircraft the main force would fly over it, but you could get a fix. You knew that that marker, you knew it was in one nautical mile, because it was dropped by H2S or later by Oval. And so gradually you brought the force closer and closer together, and that's only by navigation, and it's only by this tremendous impulse that Bennett gave to his crews at the time. And that's why we got nearer and ever nearer to our targets, and got with heavier weight, bigger and better bombs, as I've said, and by no means least, better crews.
Do any of the Pathfinder raids that you took part in stick out in your mind that you can relate to me?
Yes.
Which ones?
I can relate two, that if I don't relate them to you, somebody else will. They were a complete and absolute balls up on my part. Now, the first, before we were to start the Hamburg raids in January of 43, and I led a force of 640 or 50, 650, we'll say, mostly heavy bombers, on a raid on Hamburg. And this was to be the beginning of the Hamburg raid. And with H2S, and my H2S is working like a charm, and my operator, whose father was Churchill's bodyguard, Inspector Thompson, my navigator Thompson, he operated this like somebody working a Wurlitzer organ. He was superb. And I got, I was very, and we were coming down from the north, very, very strong wind. By this time we were flying at 18,000 feet. Very strong wind, our ground speed was very high. But we measured the Elbe at a where it should have been, we'll say, 5 or 7 miles wide, you know, on the lead out of Hamburg, or 5 miles, say 5 miles wide. We measured that at a lesser, because you put a transparency on top of your scope, and when you saw the target coming down and getting in transit with your transparency, that's when you dropped. And so, on this occasion, we mistook, and this was our fault, we mistook the width, and we saw a great big splosh on the H2S, which was a place 18 miles downriver of Hamburg, and we dropped our first indicators there. Fortunately, I was the first of the four markers. And the chap behind me, his H2S was working just as well, and he was able to turn very quickly and aim, you know, 80 miles. You can see 80 miles, it's just over there, you know, at 45 degrees when you're up at 18,000 feet. That's called Hamish's Shame. And the other raid was just before we had H2S, was a raid on a place on the Rhine, and the target was on little loops in the Rhine, but one of the loops again was 20 miles away from the other, and we marked the wrong one. That's called the one was called Hamish's Shame, and the other one was called Mahaddy's Folly. And these are things I talked about when I went round lecturing to the crews, how easy it is. But these were mistakes.
When was the second one?
The one on the Rhine was Saarlouis and Saarbrücken. Saarbrücken, these two, you know, the Rhine goes down in loops, and they were about 20 miles apart. And this is by dead reckoning. And we dropped flares in those days. And the moment my string of flares went across this loop, and I could hardly believe it. But by this time, I knew my navigator was very, very good indeed. And he was only doing this is before H2S, he was only doing this on G, getting good G-fixes across the sea and getting good wind and making alterations to his wind. And he says, you know, we're being pushed a little south or being pushed a little north, and then putting a fresh wind, and then the next time he had a quick G-fix. This got us all the time nearer and ever nearer when we started. We're into 43. And so I told people about these things. These are the two things that are vivid in my memory. The one in Cologne in February, when I got my squirt of 174 cannon shells, there's something I couldn't do anything about at all, but nevertheless I'm trying to give you the progression here. Then each stress comes along, then of course everything changed dramatically when Obo came. Now I tell my listeners that Obo could drop a marker from 30,000 feet. Mosquito Obo aircraft could drop a marker onto a football field. That is the type of accuracy. There was some that weren't as good as that, but that was the general feeling. Now, we couldn't even look at the Ruhr because it's a tremendous mishmash. Just think of the whole of the south of England, you know, turned that way, roughly. The south of England, the whole of south of England, from Kent to way down to Plymouth, turned that, and that is the Ruhr, and it's one town runs into another. We couldn't even get anywhere near Krupps until Obo came along, and we knew, despite the tremendous flak and searchlights, we knew that Obo could drop its markers within that sort of area. Maybe not as accurate in the Ruhr, because although they didn't have much trouble with guns at 30,000 feet, because everything was fused for 18,000-20,000 feet where we operated. And this were in the early days of Obo. Later on, when they started sending the 262s, you know, the jet 262 after us, but their losses never got beyond the half of 1%.
Now, you said earlier that the Americans should never have adopted the strategy that they did, that they should have come along with our night bombing.
Yeah,
why do you say that?
Well, you see, they said we can bomb into a pickle barrel with our Norden bombsight, frightfully accurate. And a very, very good bomb site. They were talking about bombing something in the Arizona desert, you see? And that's a guy comes along with his Norden bomb site, and he's away up there at nearly 30,000 feet, the fortress could get up to, and he could bomb very accurately. I don't know the figure that a squadron, they used to talk of a figure of 30 yards, you know, which may. I never seen it, and I'll accept it. But there, they have a squadron or a wing of fortresses stretched out a mile apart, you know, a mile in breadth, and maybe a division 3 miles this way. I don't see how they can bomb into a pickle barrel. And no American, and I've challenged them with this, and they give a bit of a giggle and say, well, you know, we were doing the same thing as you, really. We were just area bombing, but they weren't. Our area bomb is very highly concentrated. And when we went to a target, you know, I'm talking, getting into 43, 44, we could go where we like. And once we were on the continent, there was another great plus for us. We only had halfway across Europe to go before we got to Germany. And if we got beaten up by the guns of fighters, we could always bail out over occupied territory.
We've been talking.
I'd rather not talk about the, unless I'm talking to Americans. You're not American, are you?
No.
I do like to take the piss out of them, frankly, and I do it with great skill and low Scotch cunning.
Can I ask you about Bennett? Because you've talked about his remarkable qualifications.
Yes.
But you haven't talked about him as a person. Did you get to know him as a person?
I got very near. I was more... Not at first. I thought no more of him than anybody else did. I thought he was a bumptious upstart. But then, once I served on his staff, and I was very close to him, I became very, very near to Bennett. And the fact that he pulled me out of my squadron short of the magic, 60... and I felt very hurt about that, particularly as the first night my crew went without me, they were all killed, and that took an awful lot of getting over. In fact, I never got over it in the war years, and it's something that's a bile that comes back.
Did you feel resentful towards
him? I'm very resentful at the time, and then I realised what he was doing, and then I realised his full value. Because not only was he having to persuade Bomber Command, and I'll say Bomber Command, and Harris was a supporter, and I think I'm going to leave how much of a supporter he was to Sid Bufton. My little story is not complete until you've spoken to Bufton. I believe sincerely that the command were highly jubilant if ever we made a mistake, which was not often. My two mistakes are the only two glaring mistakes, because I used to lecture about them, and that was when I was drawing in Pathfinders, going to every squadron, every station, every squadron, everybody that was on duty in that station at that time listened to me, and I told them how easy it was. And then they looked at me, completed two tours, and I had a great deal of awards for my two tours, which sound a bit doubtful now, but nevertheless said, well, that little guy, he's got all these gongs and he's done two tours, well, I can bloody well do that. And I told them, I said, but don't make my mistake. Do as I tell you to do, which is their old naval tradition. The old naval padre used to tell the sailors, do as I tell you to do, you see.
We were talking about Bennett, though,
yeah.
And you said that many people thought he was bumptious.
Yes.
Did you feel that yourself?
Initially, because when he came to analyse my first Sir Louis and Sir Bochum, it was a little sort of court of inquiry. His senior navigator, a fellow called Anderson, dead now, his chief intelligence officer himself, and he came and he analysed. He made it very clear that I wasn't at Sir Louis, I was at Sir Bochum, or whichever one it was, I can't remember now, Sir Louis or Sir Bochum, and he gave me a very hard time. And naturally, with my background and experience, I didn't like it. But then when I went to work for him, which is only a few months later, I saw him, in the cold light of day, and I saw what he was doing. And I had to admire what he was doing. And I had to admit that here was something that we'd never experienced in our life before, and never certainly experienced in our Air Force or any Air Force, a man of his background and a man of his ability and attainment.
You said that you eventually understood why he'd pulled you out. What did you mean by that?
Well, he wanted me and I've never really understood the reason for this, and I never got round to it. I was always going to ask him about it. In fact, the only answer I ever got out of him when I started to talk about this was I said, you know, I felt very hard about losing my crew. And he said, well, Hamish, I needed you better. It was more important that I got better crews. You see, just about the time when would it be? After I'd been 7 or 8 months in my squadron, I was commanding 7 squadron. Bennett's crews, I probably started it by making it very obvious to Bennett that our crews that we were getting were not up to the standard, and the other squadron commanders were complaining about the poor standard of crews. And so the only thing that Bennett complained then to Harris, and then whether it was Harris or whoever challenged, well, you'll have to go and you pick your own crews. Squadrons pick crews. Chaps on a squadron had to volunteer. They had to put in a written application to volunteer and go on the Pathfinder. So that application arrived in front of the squadron commander. He just tore it up and put it in the ash can. He says, and when I used to challenge about this time, and I hadn't left my squadron, this was all going on in outside squadrons and outside groups, and it was going on between Bennett and the groups and the command, Harris. We used to get a printout, a foolscap printout of the bomb plot. Every aircraft target in the centre, and you got a little blob with the 97 P for Peter, 97 squadron, and that was a photo flash, and that had been plotted, and there it was on this plot, half a mile, quarter of a mile, or on the aiming point. Of course, the aiming point is a city, for Christ's sake, you see. And so these bomb plots. Now, if you sent, say, at that time, I'm top 43, you'd be sending out to a single target. You might be sending out, by this time, 450, 500 aircraft, because that was the build-up, you know. The four-engine aircraft are coming out now, you see. And so, you would have, of the 450, you would have no more than 10%. Of the chaps attacking that target. Now, I'm being a little unfair there. Let's say 20, a fifth. Let's say 20%. You get 20% photographs. You would get another